KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, and in fact the inaugural edition for this spring quarter on KZSU's schedule. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I'm looking forward to an exciting quarter of guests spanning a variety of topics. Today, I'm very excited to have on a return guest, Professor Bobby Kwal from DePaul University College of Law, is on the show today discussing her new book, The Soul of Creativity, Forging a Moral Rights Law for the United States. Now, for those of you who are familiar with IP law, and certainly and copyright more specifically, and that's a topic that we regularly discuss on Hearsay Culture, you know that from its foundations in the United States, the primary motivational theory and purpose behind intellectual property law, I say that broadly, although we could even quibble about things like trademark, but as a general matter, is the utilitarian theory, the idea of creating incentives, primarily economic incentives, for innovators to create. And that is the primary motivation, at least in the United States, of copyright law. In The Soul of Creativity, Bobby puts forth a very forceful argument that moral rights, which I will allow Bobby to define, but really focusing on the rights of the author as an individual, can be integrated into our intellectual property law scheme and copyright law more specifically. And Bobby's book makes the argument with reference to a variety of resources, from traditional intellectual property resources to all the way back to what we consider to be the, for at least some consider to be the formative works of religion, like the Old Testament or Hebrews and other religious texts. And Bobby also takes a close look at what authors do generally with the works that they have. So we're going to take a pretty detailed look at this argument, what the argument is that Bobby's making, some of the terminology that she uses, and the sites that she points to create this proposal, which ultimately is designed to integrate moral rights and moral rights theory into the current intellectual property law and particularly copyright framework that exists today. This is a controversial topic, and there are those that feel very strongly that moral rights should not and do not fit into our scheme. And so I think by examining this issue, we can take a critical look at this argument and take a look at it from the perspective of someone who very forcefully and articulately has put forth this proposal. Bobby, by way of background, and I'll ask more background in a moment, is the Raymond P. Nero Professor of Intellectual Property Law and the founding director of the Center for Intellectual Property Law and Information Technology at DePaul University College of Law. Bobby, thanks for coming back on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, Dave, thanks for having me once again. It was such fun last time, and I'm really excited about this time.
As am I. For those who don't know your work and perhaps didn't listen to the show earlier, though I hope they did, I'll ask you this question, rather than delve the standard question as to your background. What made you interested particularly in moral rights as a topic?
Oh, gosh, you know, to answer that, I would have to go back a really, really long time ago, Dave. You know, the very first piece that I wrote once I was hired at DePaul, so we're now going back to a publication date of 1985, was actually called Moral Rights, Copyright and Moral Rights, Is an American Marriage Possible? That was my first published piece in joining DePaul. Actually, it was my second, but it was the first one I actually wrote at DePaul as opposed to prior to being hired. It was published in the Vanderbilt Law Review. Many people have told me it's sort of become in some ways one of the standards in the moral rights copyright literature. But basically, I wrote that article prior to the enactment of the Visual Artists Rights Act, which does now afford some very limited protection for moral rights in the United States. We can talk more about that in a bit if you like. And basically what I did was a very careful analysis of copyright law and compared it to the droit moral, the moral rights that were in place in the rest of the world, and kind of looked at how moral rights could fit into our copyright, ways in which it was compatible, ways in which it was incompatible, hence the title, Is an American Marriage Possible? I don't really remember what got me interested in that, you know, back in 1984 when I wrote the piece. I think it was just, I was intrigued by the fact that there was this whole doctrinal area out there that the United States really had very little to do with, and when I looked at the documents and the research internationally, I saw really that the rest of most of the civil law tradition at that point, now it's more common in common law countries as well, but back then it was certainly most of the civil law tradition had really embraced, and I was sort of captivated a bit with the stories of artists and, you know, the whole question of authorship rights. And so that was my very first piece. And every time I thought I had everything I had said, everything I could say about moral rights, something else comes along, captures my fancy. And hence, you know, 25 years later, here I am just, you know, publishing a book on this. So
it's, you know, and it's an area that, as I mentioned in the introduction, is certainly not without support outside of the United States, but it's a more controversial idea here. And I think for, again, by way of background, for those that don't focus heavily on copyright law, we can start our discussion by the most basic of all questions, which would be, what do you mean by your title, The Soul of Creativity?
The soul of creativity. Well, you know, really what this book is about is let's look at what drives creativity and let's see how the law should be shaped in response to those drives. Okay, so in a one sentence summary, that's what this book is about. So the soul of creativity is really intended to capture the first part of the book, in which I really try to take a very careful and interdisciplinary look at what drives and what motivates human creativity, because it's an area that I believe is not sufficiently attended to in the United States utilitarian framework for copyright law. And so that's what the soul of creativity is really intended. That's the message that I intend to convey with that title.
Now, your subtitle is Forging a Moral Rights Law for the United States. And I guess the follow-up question, again, these are the basics before we get into more details, is what you mean by moral rights broadly.
Okay. Well, its most broad definition, you know, moral rights is that doctrine that protects the personal as opposed to the economic rights of an author. Okay, so that's the broadest answer I can give you, but to put a little bit of meat on those bones, the types of moral rights that are most readily understood when we say moral rights, what people really think about and concentrate on, and what this book, in fact, concentrates on, are two components of moral rights. One being the right of attribution, which basically relates to the right of an author to have his or her name attributed, to prevent misattributions, and even to publish a work anonymously or under a pseudonym if that is his or her desire to do so. They're not protected by copyright law here in the U.S. Secondly, the right of integrity. And the right of integrity, as it's typically used, and as we'll probably get into later, I define the right of integrity somewhat differently in terms of how it should play out here in the U.S. But generally, what the right of integrity refers to is basically the right of an author to make sure that her work or his work is presented to the public in a way so that it comports with his artistic vision of the work, that it's not modified in a way that damages the work's integrity and the author's authorship dignity, which is a concept that, as we can talk about, the concept of authorship dignity is really what I believe to be at the root of the theory for moral rights. So right of integrity, right of attribution, those are the two key moral rights. There are others, and the book talks about others, but for purposes of what I I typically focus on, largely it is those two rights.
Now, you start off, and again, you know, even though we have a longer period of time for the interview than most situations, on radio, we can still touch tip of the iceberg kind of stuff, but you start off the book with an assertion that there is a general lack of understanding on how the creative enterprise works, which I'll allow you to articulate in more detail, leads to perhaps critiques or a misunderstanding about where more rights might fit into the U.S. equation. Talk a bit about that lack of understanding. What do you see as you span the field as the failures or the lack of understanding that leads to the problem that we're going to talk about in a moment?
Sure. I think when we think about copyright policy in the United States, and this has been, again, we're not talking about the modern era, we're really going back to the beginning of our copyright system. And I think that there is an overemphasis, and at times, perhaps, Dave, even an exclusive emphasis on monetary concerns. You know, the rights that copyright law provide are all economically based. The right to perform, the right to distribute, the right to display, the right to make a derivative work, the right to reproduce. These are all about money. And the reason I believe that copyright is so focused on an economic perspective is that we really think about copyright law, we think about authors' rights law really from that utilitarian perspective of what commodification, how much is this worth? I'm not saying that's not important. I'm not looking to displace or totally recraft copyright law. What I'm really saying, in essence, is that unless we can move a little bit beyond just a utilitarian framework for copyright law to a point where we can consider the very basic question of what motivates creativity beyond money, and as the book discusses, there's a lot out there that motivates the human creative enterprise. And unless we can take that into our copyright discourse from a policy perspective, we're not going to be in a position to enact law that is truly responsive to authors' needs in a more comprehensive way. And that's really my argument.
So that gets us a little further to discuss this issue of morality. At least I think this is true, and you can tell me if you disagree. I think when people think about the utilitarian theory, the basic focus and the primary focus is whatever we need to do to encourage innovation, we will do up to the point that the encouragement becomes, and the incentives given actually outweigh the public's interest in having more works created. If that's true, then the initial question becomes, where does moral rights fit into that equation? In other words, do moral rights as you envision them tip the balance in favor of the author or in favor of the public, or are moral rights a separate area to consider?
That's a good question. You know, where do they tip the balance? I think the argument that I'm making in this book is I accept the balance of right versus access. You know, I accept the fact that in order to promote works of creativity, we do have to have a limited monopoly in the form of copyright. Okay, I am not saying copyright is perfect. I don't take on that question, but I accept the current policy, you know, questions. This isn't a book about whether we are over-privatizing copyright law. You know, that's not what this is about. What I'm basically saying is that within the genre of why we have copyright, okay, basically to promote progress, which as the framers understood that term means to disseminate knowledge, to disseminate knowledge. What I'm saying is within that framework, moral rights fit in. And a properly crafted moral rights system, one that is tailored to the unique concerns of the United States, not only fits in with promotion of progress and dissemination of knowledge, but actually fosters promoting progress and dissemination of knowledge. And that's really the argument that I'm making. We can talk about specifically mm-hmm. why I believe that to be the case.
Right.
But that at its, so at its best, that's what I'm saying.
So we're talking with Professor Bobby Qual of DePaul University College of Law, who is joining us by telephone from Chicago. Bobby, I guess, you know, I guess to contextualize this, and you alluded to it right at the end of your answer, and I will take the bait. Obviously, if there is an absence of a moral rights basis in U.S. copyright law that you believe should exist, there must be a problem or problems associated with that absence. So,
sure.
what do you see as the most significant downsides to the absence of a strongly worded and strong justification of moral rights in U.S. copyright law?
Sure. And I just, before I answer that, Dave, I just want to sort of put what you say strongly worded into context, because I think there are some moral rights advocates that would read my book and read the proposal at the end and say, that just doesn't go far enough. So
right.
I want to couch that term strongly, a strong advocate. I think what I'm proposing is a realistic formula for moral rights, as opposed to one that's strong. But the question
okay.
you're asking is, well, why should we care? Why is it necessary? We've gone on all this time without adequate moral rights protection. Why should we think about this now when there's other pressing things to think about? So here are, I think, some of the reasons why a renewed consideration of moral rights is very, very important at this juncture in time. First of all, you know, there's a question, a basic question of whether we are even in compliance with our obligations under the Berne Union. When we joined Berne back in 1988, I believe, you know, the idea was that, well, we kind of, sort of, you know, wink, 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 had enough moral rights, but it really was a wink, wink, wink. And everybody knew it was a wink, wink, wink. And what I'm really saying is the kinds of substitutes for moral rights that were being proposed at the time, back in 1988, which was in really a pre-digital age as well, you know, were really not adequate substitutes for our compliance with Berne. VERA, the Visual Artists' Rights Act, was enacted 2 years later. And again, the narrow structure of Berne again makes it questionable. Doesn't really give a satisfactory answer to the question of, are we in compliance with Berne? So there are treaty obligations, international treaty obligations. Again, keep in mind, most of the rest of the world, including now the common law tradition, which was always a little skittish on moral rights, it's still far ahead of where the United States is. So we are really isolated, very much so, in our position, in our anti-moral rights position. I mentioned before that we acceded to the Berne Convention in 1988, and that was a very different global economy at that point. We are now in a completely digitized age, obviously, and the capacity for violating moral rights is so much more enhanced now than it was. You know, with questions of mishmash, questions of user-generated content, it is so easy to violate someone's moral rights and to disseminate the product of that violation to countless, you know, millions and millions of people with just the press of a button. So we have very real concerns, you know, with respect to that. And then I come back to the fundamental question, which is, I think, where you started a few questions back, which is, okay, even with the international obligation questions and even with the global digital environment as it currently exists, why is this something that should capture our attention? This goes back to the question of why people create. This goes back to the question of why that we need to recognize the fundamental concept of authorship dignity. It's not just about compensating people for their works. It's also about recognizing underneath the compensation question that there's a reason why people are motivated to create works of art, and I'm using that in a broad sense, not limited to visual art. I'm using that really in relation to any aspect of authorship that would be that would come within the scope of copyright law. And there, here we have some very real questions that I think we have to ask ourselves. And so if what is motivating people to create is not just about money, okay, but there are other internal dynamics that go on oftentimes in the creative process, when the work of the creator, the author, if you will, is then taken and misattributed or not attributed or modified and still branded as the work of the author, there's really a damage to the integrity of that author. Dignity. That's what moral rights is designed to get at. It's recognition of authorship dignity. And that goes to the question directly of understanding the motivations for creativity, that they're more than just economic, and trying to basically fashion a law that would accommodate recognition for those internal dimensions of creativity that I talk about in the book.
We're talking with Professor Bobby Quall of DePaul University College of Law, author of the book The Soul of Creativity, Forging a Moral Rights Law for the United States on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Bobby, you talk in the book, and I think after the break, which is coming up in about 7 or 8 minutes, we'll get into more about your proposal. But you spend time talking about the integrity of texts as a primary concern, or safeguarding the integrity of text. Now, that potentially is an explosive term for those that think about these issues and focus heavily on defenses like fair use, which I didn't read your book as challenging at all, the notion that there should be a fair use defense, quite the opposite. But the integrity of text can be explosive if it's understood to mean that there is something inherently important and valuable and ultimately required in copyright law to allow authors to preserve the text that they have put forth without alteration. So I guess my question is this: what do you mean by safeguarding the integrity of text, and how does that fit in with fair use?
Okay, well, fair use is a concept that, in my overall framework, you know, is separate and apart from moral rights. Mm-hmm. In other words, I don't make provision for fair use in my proposal for moral rights, because fair use is a doctrine that is aimed at to what extent is unpermitted copyright copying of someone else's work, to what extent should it be allowed, to what extent should it not be allowed, given the whole rights versus access balance that U.S. copyright policy has struck. That's not the question with moral rights. Okay, it's not about to what extent can you copy. And so therefore the fair use question, while it's an important one for how copyright law should be calibrated, is really not relevant to moral rights. Okay, and the reason that I don't see it as relevant to moral rights, even though I should say, to be clear, that the Visual Artist Rights Act, if you look at the text of it, does say that the law there is subject to fair use. But the reason for that is that in most moral rights scenarios, what ends up happening is that the, I'm going to call it the second comer, not the original author, but the second comer, okay? The second comer is allowed or not allowed to take the original author's work and change it or modify it, okay? They are not allowed to do that under most moral rights regimes. That would be considered a violation of the right of integrity. That would then link back to your question about the authenticity of the text, because the reason people, particularly in the United States, are very concerned about moral rights, and it's not everyone is concerned about it. Some people have concerns about integrity. Attribution is far less controversial, I believe. But putting that aside, the reason that there is concern about integrity is that question of, does it really encroach upon people's ability to think as they want and to speak as they please? You know, because remember, moral rights step in when there is otherwise no violation of copyright law. Okay, that's an important preliminary step to understand. Okay, so let me just repeat that one more time. You know, when you're talking about moral rights, you're talking about protections that are in addition to copyright law. Copyright law would allow the second comer to do X, Y, or Z, but for the existence of a moral right of integrity, which otherwise precludes unauthorized modifications. Okay, so that's how integrity functions. And I make it clear that in my, you know, in my conception of integrity, I'm talking about actions by a second comer that are not otherwise violative of copyright law.
Okay.
So now to link back to your question, you know, why should we care about preserving the text? And doesn't that sort of seem to be at odds with our policy of free expression? And what I'm really saying is, the way that integrity should be crafted in the United States, it does link back to the question of promotion of progress, dissemination of knowledge. If the goal of the Constitution is to make clear what the original author's vision is, that clarity can be achieved by appropriate moral rights protection to the extent that the audience is informed whether this is or not authentic. But what I'm not suggesting is the appropriate course of action for the United States is to bar the conduct of the second comer when that conduct is otherwise not violating copyright law. And so that's why I feel, and we can talk about how we can do that in perhaps a bit, and what that would look like specifically. But I think it's important to understand that authenticity doesn't mean no one can touch the text. Authenticity means if the text is touched and is allowed to be touched by virtue of copyright law, it's still being made clear that it has been touched, okay, that this is not the vision of the original author, and that does go to promoting progress and disseminating knowledge. It's disseminating to the audience the knowledge that this is not the original work. This was not the original vision. In that way, integrity, authenticity is protected, knowledge is protected, and authorship dignity is protected.
And I suppose in that way, the criticism that you alluded to earlier from those saying that you are not going far enough, becomes particularly pointed. Because with that explanation, I think the superficial read is that one cannot have fair use. One cannot have a parody or a satire and maintain the integrity of the text as we'd understand it from a layperson's perspective. And so,
just the opposite, Dave.
Right,
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt
you. Oh, yeah,
you,
sure, sure.
That's just the opposite.
Okay.
What I'm saying is when you have a parody of a text, the audience knows, you know, that's a parody. The audience is aware of the fact because parody is, by its nature, the audience recognizes this isn't the work of the original author. That's the whole key to what I'm saying. And so parody, and I have a very specific discussion of parody in the proposal section, parody is important to preserve, but the reason it's not violating authorship dignity is with a parody, people aren't necessarily thinking about the fact, they know this isn't the product of the original author because the author would never have allowed that in the first place. So no, parody, in many instances, if not most instances, you know, would not be violating a right of integrity as I conceptualize.
Oh no, I appreciate the clarification. I don't think I was being clear. I think what I'm saying is that's your point, and I think that one reading it without understanding what you mean, without that explanation, might see them in conflict. I don't think I was clear there either, which gets to the integrity of my text, my speech here on the show. You're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make donations to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU, and I hope that you consider making a donation to the station. So Bobby, when we think about these issues, and I alluded to this also in the introduction, you spend a good amount of time, I think understandably, given the focus of the book, on religious texts. So without much more than that, how did the religious texts fit into the analysis that you engage in?
That's kind of an interesting story. You know, when I first actually began the research for this book in earnest, I read a book by Daniel Boorstin, the former Librarian of Congress and a historian, called Creators. It was a 750-page book, and it was on the history of creativity. It's a fascinating book, and it made for a wonderfully nice summer project. But in that book, Daniel Boorstin actually talked about the creation narratives in Genesis. And he has a line in that book saying, here's a path. And he's talking about the text where God creates Adam and Eve. And he said, here's a path that leads man to think of himself as a creator. And I was really struck by that because, I had read the narratives in Genesis hundreds of times. I am practicing of my religion, and I had been writing about moral rights for about 20 years at that point. And I'd never made the connection between the Genesis creation narratives and any kind of a basis for human creativity. So kind of that eureka light bulb went off, and I thought, wow, this would be really cool. You know, let me see what the texts of the Jewish tradition say about human creativity. And I started with that tradition because that's the one that I know best. Interestingly enough, I had a research assistant who was very, very learned at that point, and he plowed a lot of the text and the rabbinic sources, came up with a wealth of information from which I distilled several key themes that run through, in particular, the Genesis narratives about why people create. And I presented that it was at DePaul at one of our faculty brown bags, and one of my colleagues said, well, Bobby, that's, you know, fine and well, but you know what? And he was right. He said, the U.S. is largely a Christian nation, so why don't you think about what Christianity has to say about why people create? So the long and the short of it is, I then did a whole lot of research on that, and from there I went into what the psychologists are saying, and from there I went into what the artists themselves are saying, as well as creativity theorists, and I realized that there were certain key themes about why people create that kept coming up over and over and over again. And so a lot of those themes really appear in the book because they provide what I think is really interesting about those internal motivations that prompt human creativity from an internal perspective. And by that I mean an intrinsic perspective, a non-economic perspective. I just want to say one more thing about that before we maybe, you know, talk about some of the specifics of the proposal, if you like. But the other thing that I wanted to say about the religious texts and the religious traditions is the more I've actually delved into this question, you know, I thought, as I said earlier, I've written with this book the last thing I could write on moral rights. And I find, you know, it seems like you're never done. And one of the things that I just realized recently is that if you then look at rabbinic literature, I'm not talking now about the Torah, I'm talking about the later rabbinic commentaries, you know, things that are called the Mishnah and the Talmud, etc., you realize there are very interesting questions of collaborative authorship and integrity of those texts and what those texts are trying to do that I really feel can help inform us today in this era of user-generated content and mishmash and things and how to decide authorship questions and integrity questions and that whole era, which, you know, is a very big problem, as the book even talks about. Collaborative authorship is really the hardest thing for moral rights. So I think there's really even more to be mined from that, and I'm actually going to do a piece and examine that intersection. But again, if you look at religion as a product of culture, you know, which I believe it to be, it's not really surprising that theological texts would have something to say about human creativity, because culture and law, in my mind, as a cultural analysis, as my bent is cultural analysis and my scholarship, that, you know, it's all intertwined. Law and culture can't really be separated. They all come from parts, you know, the same human enterprise. So that's kind of a long answer to your question, but that's how the religious text came into play.
And I think, Bobby, mentioning those issues, you force me to give a follow-up question before we get to your proposal, but I think it's an interesting one. So for those that aren't familiar, I mean, you know, something like the Talmud has brought, I mean, just to put it in simplest terms, has Jewish law, and then around literally the laws are commentaries written over time by various scholars on what that law means. So this almost, and again, I apologize if I'm oversimplifying it, but you can clarify if you choose. I'm going to ask a question which sounds kind of silly, but I think it's an interesting one to ask. So in your study of Jewish tradition and Christian tradition, and I'll use the phrase Judeo-Christian tradition, do you see moral rights or concerns about moral rights reflected in the works of authorship themselves? That is, those comments made by human beings to the Talmud and to Jewish law.
Well, your question is actually a very good one, and it takes us a little bit far afield at the question of works of authorship, but I'm going to take a quick stab at it.
Okay, I appreciate it.
It's an important question.
Thank you.
You know, the question, for example, of Jewish law and what is the authenticity of Jewish law is a very, very important question especially for Jews today in modernity. And it's important to understand how to approach that question. You do have to go back to Talmudic sources, you know, and also to the commentaries on them, which came, you know, centuries later. But to go back to the Talmudic period when Jewish law was really being initially forged, and you have to kind of look at the agenda of the sages that were forging Jewish law, what it is they were doing, how they were reacting to polemics and to their political situations, and understand what the community looked like. And so the question of what is authenticity is, for me, it's the same issues whether you're approaching a work of authorship or you're approaching Jewish law as the text. It's the same question. It's how much can you change it without making it inauthentic? How much do you have to basically give people the right to remake it and make meaning for themselves without losing the authenticity? It's many of the same issues. And I kind of realized that when I was pretty much done with writing this book. And I realized that the same kinds of questions that we ask ourselves about how to preserve a text's integrity are really the same questions that I sort of ask myself when I put on my Jewish law hat and take off my IP hat. They're the same questions. And again, I think it comes back down to the question of these are all products of culture, and they're all products of human innovation. The Talmud, you know, more than anything, is a product of human interpretation of divine will. But I think people really don't understand the huge human component to what went into those early texts. So from my standpoint, they're asking the same questions.
We're talking with Professor Bobby Quall of DePaul University College of Law, author of the book The Soul of Creativity, Forging a Moral Rights Law for the United States. Okay, Bobby, I think we have about 15 minutes left, and so this would be a good time now to turn towards your proposal, which you've alluded to in a few answers and which I think we should delve into more deeply. So you focus on attribution and integrity rights. So to start off from the top level, broad strokes, what is your proposal to integrate moral rights into U.S. copyright law?
Okay. Well, I would say there are about five main brushstrokes that we would probably just have time to cover, you know, briefly today. The first, and we haven't talked about this yet today, so the first one is to what kinds of works should moral rights apply? And one of the book actually makes a long argument to the effect that moral rights should not apply to all works that are otherwise copyrightable. Okay, in other words, the eligibility for copyright protection that currently exists by virtue of both our statute as well as interpretation by the United States Supreme Court in the Feist case and others, is that moral rights-based, copyright originality applies to original works of authorship that are fixed in a tangible medium. And we know from the Feist case that it's a very low standard for originality, okay, a modicum of creativity and independent selection, okay, a modicum of creativity. It's a low, low standard. And many authors have, by the way, criticized that standard as being, you know, way too low. Many, many people have said copyright's originality standard needs to be ratcheted up, even apart from moral rights. What I'm saying first and foremost is that it only makes sense to apply to moral rights laws to works that have, and I talk about this in the book, that have a message and a meaning. And I define that what I mean by that in the book, but basically it's something that basically can reveal that author's personal, internal side when it came to the creating, the work. You know, that those internal motivations for creativity are reflected in the message of the work and the meaning of the work. And so certain kinds of works don't have a message and a meaning, even if we would otherwise want to have attribution. And it would be good to have attribution, and the norms are such that we have attribution. I'm thinking primarily of computer software. But as a matter of moral rights law, I don't think computer software should be covered. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have protections, but I think they have to be in a different genre other than moral rights. So for me, it should be works that manifest a heightened standard of originality with substantial creativity. Certain works would be not eligible. Other works would be eligible categorically, but may or may not qualify in a given situation. Photography is something I talk a lot about in the book, and that might be a work that's sort of on the cusp, possibly eligible, but maybe not in all cases. So that would be the first step, I guess I would say, in my proposal. Secondly, I want to say a little bit about duration, because here I really depart really strongly from the way moral rights work in the rest of the world. In the rest of the world, moral rights expire with copyright protection, or in some instances, like France, moral rights last perpetually. I say that moral rights in the U.S. should basically expire when the author expires, or if it's a multiply authored work, when the death of that last surviving joint author. I believe that limiting protection to the lifetime of the author is most consistent with the underlying theoretical predicate for moral rights, which is again aimed at recognizing authorship dignity. And though the author may well care about what happens to his work after he dies, once he dies, you know, his dignity can't really be violated in the same way. So that's a very, very substantial departure from the way moral rights works in the rest of the world. And then to go on, I talk about how attribution should be applied as well as integrity. To me, attribution should be applied much more broadly than integrity. And basically, I would make actionable uses of an author's work that are more than de minimis, uses that reproduce the work. You know, not if you use not just the work itself, but you reproduce an author's work and you don't attribute, I would also say that would, and you don't attribute, that would also violate the author's right of attribution, and false attributions I would also make actionable. In this way, I go further than Vera in some ways, because Vera does not protect reproductions. So in that way, I go farther than that. But I think attribution should be applied, you know, basically broadly. And although I eschew damages, because again, this isn't about money, although there might be instances where damage relief is the only appropriate relief, basically, I see this as basically, you need to attribute, though, you know, that the statute would say, you know, attribution must be provided, you know, in these instances. The harder question for me is integrity. And basically, in a nutshell, what I recommend is that the right of integrity should be narrowly tailored, and it should be designed to vindicate the author's right to inform the public about really the original nature of her artistic message and meaning. And how would this be done? I see this really as being done through disclaimers, so that when someone otherwise has the right to modify a work, if you've written a screenplay and you've sold the rights to a movie production company, for example, you know, the movie has the right, would presumably, to make modifications. But if it kind of goes too far and the original author is saying, hey, this is nothing like, you know, it doesn't comport with my message and meaning, there has to be, you know, disclaimer credits being given. And so in that way, the public is informed about the nature of the original work, and that this is not perhaps in keeping with that. An author also would have the right to disassociate himself or herself, which, by the way, there is precedent for that in the United Kingdom in their statute. So it's not totally out of range. And finally, and the last point that I raise in the proposal is I talk about personas, you know, personalities. And this is where the law on moral rights merges with the right of publicity, which, as you know, Dave, is a doctrine designed to protect usually celebrities, but it can be anyone, from unwanted commercial exploitation. And I raise the question of whether personas are really ought to be considered like works of authorship, to the extent that when a persona's dignity is violated by a particular action, whether here again, you know, what's really going on is an integrity violation. And if so, maybe that should be considered also within the scope of moral rights protections. So in a nutshell, those are the themes that I focus on in terms of the proposal.
So there's a lot there, and of course this is the time in the show where I always say that I start asking unfair questions, although we have a few more minutes left before I really ask the unfair questions and ask a
okay.
question that takes a half hour to answer, and I say you have, you know, 30 seconds. But I'll start with this one, and it gets to the first element of your proposal. This show, as you know, airs in the Bay Area, where software is a major industry. And
sure.
So perhaps you could elaborate on the distinction that you're drawing between software, which, as a general matter is, or code, I should say, which is copyrightable. Why shouldn't software have the same protections that you're suggesting?
Sure. And I believe I alluded to this, you know, earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I understand that the concepts of integrity and attribution may be very important in the software industry and would be something that is desirable among the software industry. And I'm not saying that they're not important. What I am saying is I don't think the doctrine of moral rights is the place to address software. First of all, there are norms that have developed mm-hmm. in the software industry that do protect attribution and actually do protect against integrity violations. And I'm all for, you know, expanding those norms and strengthening those norms. And let me just say that having adequate moral rights protection is a step toward doing that, because what we really would be creating would be, you know, creating a normative culture in which people take authorship more seriously in this.
So we are back, here we had a situation where, in the middle of our conversation involving the integrity of software, Professor Qual, Bobby's line went dead. So take that for what it's worth, but Bobby, I'll let you pick up where you left off.
Sure, yeah, Dave, I joked about the fact that the software in the Bay Area did not like my position on software.
Apparently not.
Exactly. What I was really saying was that I think having a moral rights law that applies to the works I am suggesting it apply to only, as a general matter, strengthens authorship norms generally. So that's important to keep in mind in terms of software in particular. Secondly, there are norms in place that do protect software attribution and even integrity interests, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that we cut back on those norms. In fact, I'm in favor of expanding them. But really what I'm saying is that when you talk about moral rights, it's important to understand that what drives moral rights is basically the author's desire to have the message and meaning of her work be noted and recognized and acknowledged. And that doesn't really translate into works with such a large functional component. And that's really the point that I'm making in terms of some works are going to fit and some works are just not.
So, Bobby, I'll ask you this in the about 5 minutes or so we have left. The book is new, obviously, but it's been out for a short amount of time. What's been the reaction to your proposal generally? What kind of feedback are you getting from people who don't, we can start with from the group, that don't necessarily believe themselves to ascribe to moral rights as a basis for copyright law?
Sure. You know, I think I have to say I've been really gratified by the emails that I've gotten from our colleagues, and I'm talking about professors in the academy who are not, you know, who are basically more low protectionist. I've really been gratified by emails that I've gotten from them, as well as when I was writing this, I really circulated my draft very, very widely. I have a huge list of acknowledgments in the book, and so people knew all along as it's been kind of coming to fruition. So I think the reaction that I have seen has been really positive and really strong. Of course, people may not write and say, you know, we absolutely hated your book and we think, you know, it shouldn't have been published. But I think that I haven't really even gotten any people, you know, really raising any serious questions about the fundamental premise of some of my proposals. People may take issue with certain things. I know that some people are hoping to do book reviews, and I'm sure we'll see more discussion in terms of some of what I'm proposing then. But so far, the reaction has been really strong and positive.
So then the follow-up question is, from a practical perspective, do you sense the possibility of any legislative interest in your proposals?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, I did send a copy of the book to Mary Beth Peters, the Register of Copyrights. I know that she likes moral rights. She had told me at a conference once that she has an interest in moral rights. I guess, you know, I'm not putting words in her mouth, but I do remember that in a conversation from, you know, some years back when she knew I was working on this. But, you know, realistically speaking, there's so much on the legislative agenda right now, excuse me, both in terms of copyright and non-IP and non-IP issues. So if we are going to mobilize our energies to consider moral rights, I don't see it in the very near future. But really what I hope to do with writing this book is to begin a dialogue, and to begin a serious dialogue about how we can take moral rights seriously within our framework. So would there be optimally a legislative proposal or response down the road? You know, I really hope so, and I'm an optimist, and I like to look at the world, the glass half full. So I really like to believe that this work will promote an impetus to do that. Do I think it's going to be in the next year or two? There, I would have to say, you know, probably pretty unlikely.
You know, it's a last point on that front is, you know, given the proposal, it seems like although again, I think knee-jerk people may not think of it, but it seems like a potential natural ally for a lot of what you're saying is Creative Commons, who have come up, and you allude to Lessig's work, but who have put forth the idea that attribution, in particular, needs to be something that people explicitly ask for. What's your view of that? Is there an alliance there?
I think not only is there alliance with Lessig's work in terms of attribution, but even, you know, in the public domain chapter, I actually touch on some of his views on the public domain, and actually, you know, in the governance way, you know, basically it's the quid pro quo, that just because fair use doesn't necessarily mean free use, and so there could be a quid pro quo that could be offered. Lessig has written about that, and I actually talk about that view of the public domain as one of the many that I believe to be consistent with what I'm proposing. And so I think that there is some definitely some synergy between those kinds of views and what I'm suggesting. And I would also say, you know, someone like David Lang, who, you know, is, you know, many of us consider him the grandfather of copyright law, you know, here in the United States, and such a dear man to boot. You know, David and his colleague Jeff Powell recently wrote a book called No Law, you know, basically an absent image. They're making the argument that the First Amendment wording should be basically taken fairly literally, and their book was also just published by Stanford Press. And David and I've talked a lot had over the years, and he's very low protectionist, and his views on the public domain are very, very clear. But he says, both in his book and in private conversations I've had with him, that A, attribution is important, and B, he even understands the idea of a disclaimer remedy in terms of integrity. So I guess, really, I don't think that what I'm proposing is going to be something that even the lowest of protection scholars would really find to be an anathema. I think it's a pretty, hopefully a pretty thoughtful compromise between the various kinds of ideological positions that are being asserted within IP.
And I think it is. I mean, I really enjoyed reading the book, and I think as I teach IP survey again in the fall, I'll be incorporating even more discussion of moral rights based upon what I read here. The author is Bobby Quall, professor at DePaul University College of Law. The book, The Soul of Creativity: Forging a Moral Rights Law for the United States. Bobby, again, thank you for being on the show. It was another great discussion. I look forward to seeing you down the road and having you back on the show in the future. But thanks again for taking the time here on Hearsay Culture to enlighten my listeners.
It was absolutely my pleasure, Dave, and thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that we have coming up on the show. Coming up next week, Professors Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland School of Law and Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall discussing fusion centers. Professor Shubha Ghosh at the University of Wisconsin Law School discussing some work he's doing on open government and IP, an area that of mutual interest. Laura DeNardis, the Executive Director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School, will be discussing her book, Protocol Politics, The Globalization of Internet Governance. Dr. Grant McCracken of MIT, author of the recent book, Chief Culture Officer. Professor Ken Wark of the Eugene Lang College at the New School, who wrote Hacker Manifesto, will be on the show discussing his most recent work. And closing out this quarter will be Greg Nogheim, Senior Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Down the road, I'm looking forward to having Professor Siva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the book The Googleization of Everything, on the show, as well as Professor Rebecca Eisenberg from the University of Michigan Law School and Associate Dean Mike Madison from the University of Pittsburgh Law School. As always, I do welcome suggestions on future guests. I think Bobby mentioned David Lang, who is a natural guest for the show, and so I'll be reaching out to him. But if you have other suggestions on the show, guests, comments, and so forth, you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have several ways to listen to the show. You can listen to the show live on KZSU from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time on Wednesdays. You can also get the show by podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page by typing a Stanford Center for Internet Society in the search engine. You can pick up the show also by going to Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And lastly, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can pick up all current and previous shows and find out more about what's coming up next. So I thank you for joining today on Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day. I'll talk to you next week.